And a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Tyler Brulo. We're the show where we bring you the voices behind the stories that make it into Monocle.
Coming up today, we'll be balancing diplomacy with domesticity as a Swiss couple job share for the role of ambassador.
We'll be joining the latest Occupy protest on the west coast of America.
And we'll be taking a first look at what's making the headlines in the dailies across the Asia-Pacific region.
All that right here on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Troops have fired in the air to disperse a crowd attacking government offices in Sidi Bouzid, where 10 months ago vegetable seller Mohamed Bouazizi set fire to himself in a protest that ignited revolts around the world. Rachid Ghannouchi, the leader of the Islamist party which won Tunisia's first free election, appealed for calm in the town where the Arab Spring began, accusing forces linked to the ousted president of fanning violence there. Thousands of protesters gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square today to protest to press the ruling army to speed up the transfer of power to civilian rule, and an Islamist leader said his followers would stage a sit-in if the army does not respond. Egypt's army assumed control after an uprising ousted President Mubarak on February the 11th, promising to transfer power to an elected civilian government within 6 months. A boy has been found alive 5 days after eastern Turkey was hit by a 7.2 magnitude earthquake. Rescue workers have pulled the 13-year-old from the rubble of an apartment block in the town of Erciz. The rescue lifted spirits as thousands of survivors endured a fifth freezing and wet night out in the open.
We are always standing in lines. Sometimes we wait for 2 or 3 hours, but there is nothing else we can do. We don't have tents. We sleep in the open.
We don't have tents now. We are waiting to get one.
At least 570 people are now known to have died in the disaster. Water levels in the Thai capital Bangkok continue to rise as residents flee. Large areas of the city are beginning to disappear under rising floodwater, with a peak expected this weekend. Officials warn that high tides due on Saturday, combined with the flow of runoff water from flooded areas further north, could inundate the city. The head of Europe's bailout fund sought financial support from China today to help resolve the bloc's debt crisis, saying that while no quick deal was in sight, he was still confident Beijing would keep buying bonds issued by his fund. Klaus Regling, chief executive of the European Financial Stability Facility, was in Beijing for talks with Chinese officials a day after Eurozone leaders struck a hard-fought accord on the two-year crisis that nonetheless left major economies Italy and Spain under financial market pressure. Centuries of British royal discrimination came to an end today after Commonwealth leaders agreed to drop rules that give sons precedence as heir to the throne and bar anyone in line for the crown from marrying a Roman Catholic. The 16 countries that have Queen Elizabeth as their monarch agreed to the changes put forward by the British Prime Minister David Cameron, who had called the rules of succession outdated.
The idea that a younger son should become monarch instead of an elder daughter simply because he's a man, or that a future monarch can marry someone of any faith except a Catholic. This way of thinking is at odds with the modern countries that we've all become.
And the UN cultural agency UNESCO will vote on Monday on a Palestinian request for membership, part of a wider Palestinian campaign for recognition as a state within the wider United Nations system. UNESCO's executive board decided on October the 6th to allow the 193 member countries vote on the application, angering Israel and the United States, which provides 22% of the funding of the UN subsidiary and could cut that lifeline as a result. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. Now let's take a look at the global weather with Thomas Scheffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
Very quiet weather across Europe at the moment, and no big changes on the way for the weekend either. It's not amazingly warm, but it's certainly not cold. In fact, above average temperatures for most of Europe. And through Saturday, across France, Germany, Switzerland, temperatures will be around 15 to 17 degrees. The far east of Europe and into Scandinavia, closer to the October norm, around 10 Celsius here. And not much rain around in Europe over the weekend either. The UK, however, will get some rain, but mainly in the west. Now, here's the weekend city forecast. Rome, very warm at 23 degrees. It'll be dry and sunny. In Geneva, 17 Celsius, sun and a few clouds through Saturday. Monaco, very warm indeed, 25 degrees, also sunshine here. In London, an impressive 17 degrees as we go through Saturday. It's the second weekend in a row that we're getting good weather in London. In Warsaw, 14 Celsius, dry and bright too. Now, as far as air travel's concerned, there is a huge area of high pressure over Europe at the moment, and this time of year, it's the fog that often causes problems at airports. Anywhere really is at risk of morning fog from Zurich to Berlin. Now, over the Atlantic, as ever, the jet stream is racing away. There are also a couple of storms in the North Atlantic, just south of Iceland and south of Greenland, but you'll be most certainly flying above the weather here, so a generally quiet westbound flight until you get over eastern Canada. Turbulence here is on the weather maps. So that was Europe. Let's go over to North America now. And there's been some pretty unpleasant weather across New York State into New England, a rain, snow and ice mix of weather. Through early Friday local time, the weather should be clearing, giving way to a much better Friday afternoon. So other than that, Mother Nature will bring some good weather and fall colours this weekend. It's Halloween weekend over the United States. Plenty of trick-or-treaters there. The city forecast then for Friday and into the weekend. New York City, a sunny Friday, but Saturday could be wet and windy and highs of only 9 degrees. Chicago, sunshine and 12 Celsius. Las Vegas at 26 and not a cloud in the sky in the desert. And in San Diego, similarly, blue skies are expected and highs of 24. Air travel, no big problems across the United States through the weekend. As far as mid-air travel goes across the Atlantic through Friday, the jet stream is shifting away a little bit, so the main area of turbulence with heavy weather will be just off Nova Scotia in the Atlantic. If you're flying to London Heathrow from the Big Apple, the weather looks generally clear, as you'll probably be flying way north of this area of turbulence. And a quick update as far as the Caribbean weather goes, and Hurricane Rina no more. It's Tropical Storm Rina now, losing its power very quickly. The effects were not substantial over the Yucatan Peninsula, so the storm is basically fizzling out. So that's good news there. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
The Propa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Det är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Emma Nelson, and I'm joined momentarily by Tyler Brulé. He's very kindly ducked out of his normal day job, which is running everything at Monocle, to come and help me out with the front pages in the early morning editions in the Asia Pacific. Thank you, Tyler.
Not at all. This is a little glance at what people are waking up to in Japan, Korea, and Australia.
We'll
be waking up to, because some of them are going to bed still. Why don't we start in Australia, where there was a bit of a sounds like a bit of a set to yesterday at the annual general meeting for Qantas, and as we've been sort of covering over the last week, Qantas has popped up a couple of times. Massive labor dispute issues there, and really an airline which is in flux, because we've seen, you know, a lot of discussion about outsourcing. Qantas has quite successfully launched a discount airline as well in the form of Jetstar. It has various spin-offs across Asia. There's now a question over this new premium airline. We've been hearing all sorts of things about this new premium carrier that's going to be flying out of an Asian hub. It'll be a Qantas-backed airline. What that's going to mean for Qantas as a legacy carrier. But it's interesting, despite all of the labor setbacks, the shareholders voted unanimously in favor. 96% of the votes were cast in favor of Qantas's executive pay card, which is one of the most contentious elements of the meeting, as you can imagine.
It is quite astonishing, because they have pretty much gone and flown in the face of all the unions, who are desperate for them to recognise the fact that the long haul pilots, the aircraft engineers, and the ground crew all are massively against this. And the ground crew have already been on strike for an hour, and they're going to increase industrial traction, and Qantas is saying that they're losing money. This is just counterintuitive.
And at the worst time of year as well, because I'm sure they have a lot of forward bookings already shored up. But you know, there's of course a number of people still who haven't decided what they're doing for the holidays. Are they going to fly home to see their family in Melbourne, Perth, or Sydney? What carrier are they going to go on? So I think when there are so many question marks around the airline, it's not great. And it does remind you, have to recall that the British Airways used to have an interest in Qantas. It sold out and did quite well on the deal. But the labor situation at Qantas, you know, does remind you of some of what we've been hearing from British Airways as well. You know, a real bust up between management and the unions.
Oh, this was a long-term bitter war between British Airways and the unions, insofar as it was either paying conditions or pensions or holidays. And although many other airlines were saying, look, everybody else has a much harsher deal than British Airways, still the unions were digging in and refusing to do anything about it. But what astonishes me about the Qantas story is that the government is now ready. It says it's ready to use its legal powers of intervention. Mm. Now, the British government didn't actually wade in that far with British Airways. It let them get on with it. But the Aussies are different.
They are. And I think that also, I mean, really, if you look at the situation that Qantas is in, it's bad for brand Australia. And I think that's why you can hear this type of government language as well. Yes, BA is the flag carrier in this country, but it has, you know, a reasonably strong competitor in the form of Virgin as a second airline. Whereas, you know, Australia really, you know, depends in terms of trade links, but also just, you know, flying the flag. Qantas is incredibly important. And I do worry at the moment. I think we've seen all of the industrial elements that have surrounded British Airways. And it's damaged the brand enormously. And a lot of people would argue that British Airways is not the carrier, it's not the brand that, you know, that used to connect people the way it did a decade ago. Part of it is also the problems with Heathrow as well.
And could this happen to Qantas, the way that British Airways has been tarnished?
Exactly. I think that's just it. When you have so many aggressive players in the form of Thai Airways, you know, Singapore Airlines, Cathay, not to mention the Etihads, the Emirates, the Qatars as well, who've taken a huge chunk.
Oh, they take luxury now. They make luxury a standard.
Well, they do, and they're using, you know, Dubai or Abu Dhabi or Doha as their connection points, and they've taken a lot of market share, certainly from Qantas on the, you know, what was a highly profitable Kangaroo route.
What is astonishing, though, is that the shareholders are overwhelmingly supporting the management and their decision to take an enormous pay. That just sounds entirely counterintuitive in this day and age.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to turn to the Korea Herald. A couple of stories there. Obviously, we've had the U.S. Defense Secretary, Leon Panetta, has been there. So there's been a lot of talks about a defense plan. So the paper, I would say, is leading on two stories. One is that allies to write defense plan on North Korea, between South Korea and the U.S. And, of course, you know, the United States has an enormous garrison base there. Also, Samsung posts forecast beating quarterly earnings. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, other stories concerning also just the total sales, that Samsung beat Apple in smartphone sales, which is really quite something.
Oh, they didn't just beat them, they beat them into fifth place. There were four other competitors behind them. I think it was Samsung was... This is to do with a shipment of smartphones.
Correct, exactly.
And their Galaxy smartphone, which has got super duper new technology, which is, you know, which is actually astonishing the market. And they shipped 27.8 million of these units between July and September.
Huge
That's
number.
10 million more than Apple.
Yeah.
And Apple are sort of relegated, if that is an accurate word, to the likes of Nokia, who at the moment have that terrible problem of having to recreate themselves as a global brand that's gone away.
Yeah, it's interesting. Also, if anyone was listening to last night's program on The Daily, we had Marco Attasari on from Apple. So it's the fight becomes a little bit more interesting right now. Leadership, you know, questions around, you know, what direction, you know, will Apple take? I think clearly it's still on a steady course, no question there. But the playing field might be a little bit more level now, with Nokia now having a phone which will have a Windows, you know, user interface. And then, of course, you have, you know, Samsung. I mean, just, you know, certainly not even taking a breath. I mean, they're really going for it.
One of the reasons why apparently Apple did so comparatively badly is that one of the excuses that the people are waiting for the iPhone 4S to turn up. Do you think that Apple will just turn it all around in the next quarter and sort out
Samsung?
I think
we have to wait and see. You know, we've look at Korea has been so aggressive, and you know, and in many ways they almost beat the consumers into submission, just with you know, with the pure power of brand, and also you know, there is a price element, and as you say, you know, if any number of brands right now, you know, potentially miss a launch, you know, consumers can very easily be upsold.
And Samsung are having—they're doing really well in the smartphones, but they're doing terribly badly in things like memory chips. That's what's gone, and that's what's caused their profits to dip. That we're seeing on the front cover of the Korea Herald. This is the tomorrow morning, well, Saturday morning's edition, first edition coming through. Well, thank you very much indeed for that, Tyler. We'll
not
take
at all.
A quick look at the time now. It's 4:15 the hour here in London. In a moment, we'll be talking to one of Canada's top newsmen, but we'll be back in a moment.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Then a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24 is your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle Coxigumataneria.
The Bropa Jalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And a very warm welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with Emma Nelson and Tyler Brulé.
Tony Berman has been a journalist and news executive for over 30 years. He was at the helm of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's newsgathering division from 2000 to 2007 before joining Al Jazeera as MD of its English language channel. He's now back in Canada teaching journalism, I think at my old alma mater, I believe, and tomorrow sees the publication of his first column in the Toronto Star's new World Weekly section. We have Mr. Berman on the line now from Toronto to talk about all things media. Hello, Mr. Berman.
Hi, nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm great.
Let's start with what's going to premiere tomorrow, and we can move on to some other things. But it seems to be quite an interesting move in a country which probably globally people think about the Globe and Mail, maybe to a lesser point they think about the National Post. But here's the Toronto Star launching a World Weekly section, which is going to be for clearly for people who subscribe to home delivery. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I mean, it's a calculation. I think a very smart one, in my view, by the Star, that there's a much greater interest and appetite for international news in Canada than often media managers and the market acknowledges. And I think that the Saturday edition of the Toronto Star is very similar to the Sunday edition of the UK papers or the Sunday New York Times. It's the largest and most popular single newspaper in Canada. And what's being launched tomorrow will be, a weekly, I think they call it World Weekly, section that will try to explore it with context and with background a lot of the key international issues that really have an impact on the daily lives of Canadians. And I'm delighted that, one of the aspects of it will be a new weekly column by me.
For listeners who are familiar with certainly the competitive and also format aspects of the British Sundays, will it have a different look and feel, or will it be a regular section of the paper just with a different banner?
It will have a different feel. I mean, it's the Saturday competition in Canada is very much like the Sunday competition in the UK, where the newspapers kind of lay out their biggest feature sections. And in Toronto, there are about three or four daily newspapers, which is, you know, incredibly, as you know, unique and rare in North America. So I think it really is an effort. It'll look, I think, to a lot of viewers more like a magazine than certainly a regular news section, and hopefully the response by readers will be as I think most of us expect, which is that thank God it's here and it's been a long time coming.
And that being the case, that it's just, what is it? It's a little after 1 o'clock in Toronto on a Friday afternoon. I imagine the section is already shipped off to the printers, so you can, I guess, give us a little bit of a preview of what you're going to be talking about in your first column.
Well, in my column, I'm you know, reflecting on the Arab Spring. I mean, which is probably somewhat expected as a former MD of Al Jazeera, and I kind of try to really focus on you know, the wider meaning that there is, particularly in North America, somewhat in the British press as well, a kind of a negative spin that often or an alarmist feeling that you know, there's something going on within the Arab world that ultimately will turn wrong. We'll go, and I think that I kind of cite the Tunisian election last Sunday, you know, where you had not more than 90% of of the electric actually going to the polls is a real reason for us as North Americans to do two things: a, to be hopeful and to be optimistic that this incredible kind of Arab revolution will turn out right for them and ultimately for the world, and also that the West should just get out of the way, because it's very much remembered by most Arabs that a year ago, you know, a lot of these countries, Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, were in fact ruled by dictators backed and supported by Western governments. So my kind of effort tomorrow, and I also talk about the rather, in my view, dismal kind of Canadian role in the Arab world. So it's really an effort to kind of cut through a lot of the what I think is the media alarmist nonsense about what the Arab Spring is all about.
When you mentioned the dismal Canadian role, are you talking from a diplomatic perspective, a news gathering perspective, or potentially both?
Yeah, no, I'm from a government perspective. Mm. I think that, again, as I think many of your listeners know, I mean, there's been a kind of a long reputation for Canada to be a kind of a constructive, honest broker in a lot of sensitive disputes, and certainly for decades, the Canadian government has been that in terms of the volatile Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But the role of the Canadian government in the past several years has been to really be a cheerleader for one side, for the Israeli position. And I think in so doing, I think the Canadian government really has been more or less kind of deemed as irrelevant in the whole discussion in the Arab world, and I think a lot of Canadians are not as aware of that as I think they should be, and it is a retreat from previous positions, but I think from the Arab and the Middle Eastern perspective, with the Americans really being very ineffectual, it also just means that a country like Canada, that in the past has been very helpful and constructive, is now totally on the sidelines.
Being on the sidelines, it might be a pickup point also when you mention the Americans, and maybe we have to lump Canada in as well.
Yep.
Many said, you know, when the Arab Spring really broke and really kicked off as a story, that so many of the U.S. networks were really caught on the back foot, and probably one could argue the same about the CBC and CTV as well in Canada. Do you think this is going to bring about a change in news gathering? And I guess the second part of that, has that also spelled an opportunity as well for Al Jazeera? Because maybe people said, you know, we should just leave it to an Al Jazeera. We'll just take the feed. We'll use their correspondents. Do we even need to be as far as London anymore? What's going to happen with news gathering for, let's say, the traditional legacy networks in North America, do you think?
Yeah, well, I don't. I mean, I think there's no, now that I'm back in North America after several years in the Middle East, I think there's no particular reason for optimism that, the kind of the bottom line budget squeeze that affects a lot of these decisions will change. I mean, I think a lot of networks that in fact do have the resources to cover the world, they've just decided on their own, that Canadians or Americans for that matter are not that interested in world coverage. So they've just used that as an excuse. But I don't think there's any, in spite of the fact the world is getting incredibly small, in spite of the fact that what's going on beyond the borders of North America has a real impact on North Americans, I don't think the pattern will change. So in that sense, Al Jazeera is coming around or coming along at exactly the right time. I think there are a lot of North Americans that are now turning to Al Jazeera. They're turning to more so to the BBC, to international global broadcasters, to get a sense of what's going on beyond their borders. I would love to have the best of both, in other words, the CBC or Canadian news organizations as well as American news organizations covering the world, as well as the Al Jazeera and the BBC. But I think that's not really in the cards, I think, for a while.
Tony, it's Emma. I'm presenting with Tyler today on Midori House. Just to ask you, you talk about the Al Jazeera approach and the BBC approach and the United States approach. What, in your ideal world, if you were running a Canadian, a Canadian 24-hour newsroom, what kind of agenda would you be driving, and how do you think this should be reflected in the Toronto Star's work?
Well, I mean, I think it, as it relates to broadcast organizations, I think the I think the Al Jazeera model, is a very good one, which is that you have reporters and journalists in as many locations as possible. And Jazeera's case, I think, with the Arabic and English service, I think is more than 70 bureaus, which means that you have journalists all over the Arab countries when the Arab Spring occurs, that you already have journalists in Gaza before the Israeli-Gaza conflict. So there isn't that kind of element of surprise which occurs so much in North American journalism. I'm a great admirer of the BBC, but again, for financial reasons, which you're far more familiar with than I, there's been an incredible and gradual cutback of international coverage on the BBC as well. So my starting point in terms of successful coverage of the world is that you have people that are anchored in these countries, and that's where I think that a lot of news organizations, like, again, for financial reasons, have really cut back. And I think in that sense, it's a model that it's difficult to replicate depending on your bottom line.
And when you talk about contracting newsrooms, to what degree do you think this is actually going to be affecting world coverage of news?
Well, I mean, it is in the sense that, in the past year, when I moved from Doha back to North America, I spent the past year in Washington as their head of strategy for Al Jazeera, and I was actually appalled, having been out of the continent, so to speak, for almost 4 years, the decline of American coverage of the world. And I think the end result of that is that you have incredibly uninformed political decisions that flow from an electorate that that isn't really well informed. So you have a political class that's able to distort and misrepresent international issues and a kind of a voting population that isn't informed enough to challenge them. So I think in that sense, the decline of sophisticated, thorough international coverage for Americans is a decline in the quality of the political decisions that are made. And I think that's where I think and Al Jazeera in its own way is trying to fill the vacuum. I think other news organizations are as well. But I mean, that doesn't take away the fact that Americans generally prefer American news organizations in the same way that Canadians and British viewers and listeners prefer their own organizations. So I think we're in a kind of a box here that does have, I think, an impact on the quality of kind of public policy.
Tony, just before we go, I was co-presenting our morning program for the past 2 days with our friend Mr. John Owen, and right. One of the things we were talking about was whether there was a missed opportunity, not just in Canada, but if you looked across the top of the world and you look to Norway and Sweden and Finland and Denmark, where there are certainly many shared values, and do you think that there could be scope still for another type of English language news network which might really play to more the social democratic values of those countries I mentioned? Because of course the old news world in Canada used to be broadcast, very well across the border, across the United States. Could that even be a reality? And is there room for another English language news channel in the world?
Yeah, well, I think there is room, and I think that's a brilliant idea. And I think the Al Jazeera model, stems from a calculation made by this organization that there was a vacuum to be filled, that people did not like the idea of being dependent only on the CNN or on the BBC, and that there was a niche to fill in the developing world. And I think as we all know, that's the success of that's the secret for successful media. And I think in that sense, I think what you outlined is a vacuum, and how one pulls it together, having a business model that's viable is the challenge. But I certainly think that there's an appetite for it.
Well, something for all of us to think about over the weekend. Tony Berman, good luck with the column, and hope to see you soon.
Great, thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much. Coming up in a moment, we'll be asking our Shanghai correspondent what the Bhutanese are doing to boost their tourism. Tyler, you're ducking out now, aren't you?
I'm zipping off. I'm sure I'll see you over the weekend, though.
Hope so. And before that, let's get a roundup of the headlines. Here's Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Emma. Troops have fired in the air to disperse a crowd attacking government offices in the Tunisian town of Sidi Bouzid, where 10 months ago vegetable seller Mohamed Bouazizi set fire to himself in a protest that ignited revolts around the Arab world. Thousands of protesters gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square today to press the ruling army to speed up the transfer of power to civilian rule, and an Islamist leader said his followers would stage a sit-in if the army does not respond. A boy has been found alive 5 days after eastern Turkey was hit by a 7.2 magnitude earthquake. Rescue workers have pulled the 13-year-old from the rubble of an apartment block in the town of Erciş. Water levels in the Thai capital Bangkok continue to rise as residents flee. Large areas of the city are beginning to disappear under rising floodwater, with a peak expected this weekend. The head of Europe's bailout fund sought financial support from China today to help resolve the bloc's debt crisis, saying that while no quick deal was in sight, he was still confident Beijing would keep buying bonds issued by his fund. Centuries of British royal discrimination came to an end today after Commonwealth leaders agreed to drop rules that give sons precedence as heir to the throne and bar anyone in line for the crown from marrying a Roman Catholic. UN cultural agency UNESCO will vote on Monday on a Palestinian request for membership, part of a wider Palestinian campaign for recognition as a state within the wider United Nations system. A gunman with an automatic weapon opened fire at the United States Embassy in the Bosnian capital Sarajevo today, and police rushed to the scene. And finally, Russia's Bolshoi Theatre has reopened after a lavish renovation that took 6 years, cost $700 million, and revived a revered cultural symbol scarred by centuries of use and abuse. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. It's just past the bottom of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Now let's turn to the World Design Capital. That's a designated title by the International Council of the Society of Industrial Design. The prize is given to a city every 2 years. Yesterday, the announcement was made that the 2014 title will go, quite surprisingly, to the outsider Cape Town. The South African capital triumphed from a shortlist that included Bilbao and Dublin. Our design editor Hugo MacDonald has spoken to Guy Lundy, who's the chief executive of Accelerate in Cape Town, who'll tell us more.
We have Guy Lundy, chief executive of Accelerate Cape Town, on the line to tell us more. First of all, congratulations, Guy.
Thank you very much.
I imagine that the mood must be quite high in Cape Town at the moment, is it?
Certainly amongst the design community, there is a tremendous happiness that's going around town. I think the interesting next step is to get the rest of Cape Town to understand exactly what this means for us.
Well, that's quite interesting that you say that, because I've spent quite a lot of the past year in Helsinki talking to various people who are officially involved in the World Design Capital designation. And for our listeners who don't know, Helsinki is World Design Capital in 2012. But what's surprised me so much is how the entire city, and not just the creative communities, have got behind the bid. And not just the bid, but also what they want to do next year. They see it as an opportunity for all of them to sort of make something of this. And do you think it's going to be a difficult thing to persuade the whole city of Cape Town to get behind it?
No, but I think it's one of the first things that we need to do. As soon as the team comes back from Taipei, where the announcement was made yesterday, we need to get on the road to start explaining to ordinary Cape Townians exactly why design is part of everything that they do with their lives, whether it involves public transport or housing or the products that they use or the services that get delivered to them. Design is an integral part of everything they do, but most people don't know that and don't understand that. So there is going to be an education process. I think, though, that most people in the city are going to get behind it, because it certainly helps to put us back onto the world stage after a very successful World Cup during 2010.
Definitely. And, I mean, the best thing about the World Design Capital title is that it does focus, certainly, the attention of design communities around the world and many other people, focuses the spotlight on your city. It's a real opportunity to show that you have the power to change and improve quality of life in your city around design and architecture. But, I mean, is there a very strong design and architecture community in Cape Town already?
There is, in fact, and the unfortunate thing is that because our natural beauty is so well known, it kind of overshadows what else we have to offer. And we have a very strong design and creative community in Cape Town. And this gives us an opportunity to almost come out of the shadow of the natural beauty and really start showcasing some of the creative talent that we have, which in reality, in many cases, is attracted to Cape Town because of the natural beauty.
Guy, I was actually speaking to Jeremy Myerson, who was part of the selection committee earlier today, and he was saying that your bid was incredibly sort of moving and very strong. And, well, he was quite diplomatic and said that obviously Bilbao and Dublin came in with very good bids as well, but you were quite instrumental in the bid for Cape Town. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about it.
One of the things that we focused on with the bid was really around how design can be used to drive social transformation. I think that the reality across South Africa, and it's not only a problem that affects Cape Town, is that the history of apartheid has meant that cities have been designed for separation. And one of the things that we still need to get right after freedom in 1994 is how do we redesign the cities for inclusivity? And so one of the real core of what we put across in the bid was how we can use design to transform life. And the strapline of the bid was live, design, transform life. So it was really about using design in all sorts of ways to change the way that people live and the way that people interact and the whole nature of the city going forward. So it was very much a future-looking, forward-looking bid.
Well, thank you very much, Guy, for joining us. I look forward to coming to Cape Town and seeing the plans that you have in process and meeting you, hopefully.
Great. We look forward to welcoming you.
That was Guy Lundy there talking to our design editor, Hugo McDonald. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
To Midori House here on Monocle 24, while the Occupy protest gathers pace and scope across the globe. Here in London, the church has even got involved as protests embed themselves on the steps of St Paul's Cathedral. But over in the United States, the protest that started against Wall Street is steadily moving west. Now, our San Francisco correspondent Alistair G should hopefully join us live on the phone from the thick of one of the Occupy protests. He's in Occupy San Francisco. Alistair, what can you tell me about what's going on, please?
Well, it's a very colourful encampment, festooned with banners, palm trees, they've got banners stuck to them, multicolour tents everywhere, there are banners reading, we are the 1%, don't hate, participate in your democracy. And, there's a real sense that people are sort of living here. I mean, I just walked through the encampment now and people are sweeping the sidewalks, there are book exchanges, people are meditating in front of small trees, so there's a real sense of a sort of permanent community here.
It sounds like absolutely great fun and very little like a protest. One of the criticisms that we've been hearing for a while is that the Occupy protest has lacks a focus. Now, from the placards and the banners that you can see, what is the message that these people are trying to get across?
I think people are angry that there's a sense that sort of a 1%, a very rich American, the government is sort of really beholden to this 1%, and that their income is grown wildly while the sort of the income over the years of the 99% hasn't grown as considerably. So there's a real sense of economic inequality that some people in this society are benefiting and some are not. So that seems to be the real gist of it.
And what's the mood among the protesters? Do they seem in it for the long haul? Are they happy, sad? What are they saying to you?
Well, I just spoke to a guy called Brian, actually. He did sort of dungarees and smoking, and you know, they all seem sort of fairly content. I mean, they don't seem, you know, there isn't a real sense of sort of visceral anger here. It's more just a sense of, you know, obstinacy and, you know, we won't be moved and you know, take us seriously. That seems to be the vibe here.
I mean, having said that, San Francisco sounds all well and good, but the mood in Oakland has been quite different over the past few days, hasn't it?
Yeah, and excuse that police car in the background. Yeah, it has. The other day, there were police warned protesters that they should that it was illegal for them to be camping in front of City Hall, and so eventually they came in with tear gas, and about 50 people were arrested, and one person, an Iraq war veteran, was taken to hospital with a fractured skull. So it's been a lot more violent over there, although I will say that in recent days, since that happened, you know, people have re-entrenched there, and I think actually the injury of that vet has really sort of solidified the sentiment across the United States, in fact. And so, you know, I've heard reports now that there are 25 tents back in front of City Hall where they'd previously been removed. So there's a real sense of, you know, that in fact that attack by police may have revivified the movement.
And there also seems to be an investigation underway into the attack. I think it's on a Marine called Scott Olson. But this has also caused problems, not just for the bankers, who, by all accounts, we haven't heard anything from them yet. It's all been people dealing with protesters on a very local level. Like I said a moment ago, in London, they're camped outside the St. Paul's Cathedral. But over in Oakland, there's a standoff, isn't there, that might be causing problems for the mayor?
Yeah, well, exactly. So Mayor Jean Kwan, she was hailed as the first Asian-American female mayor in the United States, the first female mayor in Oakland, and there was a real sense that she was really out to change Oakland for the better. It's a somewhat hardscrabble city, but she hasn't come out, she hasn't fared very well in this confrontation. She allowed the police to go in and use violent tactics, possibly rubber bullets, we're hearing, and she tried to go and speak to the protesters last night to address them, but she was booed off stage. And so in a very 21st century turn, she's now released her message on Facebook. But there's a sense that this may have damaged her as well very much in Oakland.
Just one final brief question. As the Occupy protests gather scope across the United States, how much oxygen do you think is left in this story before people just sicken slightly of people in tents shouting slightly indiscriminate slogans at people?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's a very good question. I think among the protesters, first off, I mean, as I said, I think that the Oakland protests really sort of solidified the sentiment, but there are sort of, as you mentioned, there are some greater problems. There is people who live near these encampments becoming sick of it. For example, in Wall Street, there's constant drumming, which local residents are unhappy about. And there's also, and this is more of a problem for the East Coast, there's also the onset of winter, which is going to, you know, is going to be freezing in New York City. So it's an open question as to how long these protesters can continue to live outside in the open air in their tents. So it's a good question over how long these might in fact last for.
Thank you very much indeed, Alistair, who's out on a mobile phone in the middle of the Occupy protest in San Francisco, battling protesters and, by all accounts, the police, as far as I could hear then. We'll be back in a moment here on Midori House. Welcome back to Midori House Studio One with Emma Nelson. I'm now joined in the studio by Karen Krizanovic, our resident movie reviewer. A very warm welcome to you, Karen. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you.
You are hot out of a film premiere. No, a viewing. Tell us what you've been to.
A screening. I actually don't know if it's under embargo, but I will take a chance.
Tell us what you can.
I went to see In Time, which is the new film with Justin Timberlake and Amanda Seyfried. I hope I'm saying her name right. Or I still have those notes in my bag.
Oh, is this where people stop aging?
Well, it's a little bit like Logan's Run. I'm probably breaking enormous embargoes here, but the fact is that I thought it was a really good film, so I think it's okay for me to say.
So this is Justin Timberlake?
It's Justin Timberlake, that's right.
A serious actor. What's he like?
A serious actor. He's, you know, I don't think he's sexy. I don't, but he can act. You know, he is very ordinary face, but this movie is all about eyes. It's all about, well, basically it's Logan's Run, where we no longer have money, we have time. And by the time you hit 25, you have like a running, glowing, a green mark on your arm telling you how much time you've got.
A bit like a funny tattoo.
And like a funny tattoo. It's not so funny when it runs out because then you die. But if you're really, really wealthy, you've got a lot of time on your arm.
Oh, so you can buy a certain time.
And you can also have it stolen. By people will hold you up and take your time away.
And you say this is a good film.
This is fantastic.
Why?
Film. It's exciting. I actually was involved with the characters, and also it's although it's not based on this story, it's very similar to a story by Harlan Ellison, I believe, called "Repent, Harlequins at the TikTok Man," which is one of my favorites. So I'm being a bit nerdy, but then again, I spend my life in the dark.
You lucky girl.
It's not bad.
You were at a film festival premiere last night as well.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you two things.
Please.
Don't drink Prosecco.
Ever.
Not a bunch. That's the second thing I was going to tell you. Don't drink a bunch of it.
What's wrong with it?
I don't know, but it's something that my painkillers can't take it away.
Prosecco and I have always been great friends.
Really?
It's not a relationship I'm willing to give up just yet. But it's gone sour for you, has it, Karen?
Champagne's the only thing that really works for me.
Oh, I suppose you're
cursed.
Right,
but I'm going to send Mr. Prosecco over to your house next
time. It's a terrible curse to have, the curse of champagne. And I'm assuming that Mr. Prosecco got in the way of your premiere last night. Can you remember anything of the premiere last night?
No. No, actually, I do remember the film, which was wonderful. It was called Deep Blue Sea, which doesn't have sharks in it, or Samuel L. Jackson.
What does it have
in it? It's got three fantastic performances. Count them, three. Rachel Weisz, Simon, I always get his name wrong, Simon something something, and I blame the Prosecco because I can't remember, because he was brilliant. And also... Tom Hiddleston.
What was the film
was
about?
Terrific.
Can you remember that much?
I've summed it up in a nauseating word that anybody who's had several relationships will understand. It's a relationship wreck.
Right.
Relationship wreck.
Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
It's
that
about
was a Prosecco, wasn't it?
Obsessive love. That's what it's about.
Right. Okay. Well, what we're going to be talking about this afternoon or this evening or this morning, wherever you may be listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, is films that you might want to go and catch this weekend if you have a tiny little bit of spare time. And I think we're going to stick with films that have a romantic theme, aren't we? We're going to talk about a film called Like Crazy, which it's the winner of this year's Best Picture Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. It's the third feature from the director Drake Doremus, and it stars Felicity Jones. She's the latest Brit actor to be on the cusp of cracking Hollywood. The story, I am told, charts the relationship between two students who fall in love. He's American, she's British. And when her visa runs out, she has to leave the country. Before we talk about it, let's listen to a bit of it.
I thought I understood it, but I didn't. Only the idea of it. Of you and me. Falling in
with you. What are we gonna do after we graduate?
Don't think about it.
Now, listening to that, and just about to review it, is Karen Krasanovich, our film reviewer. My goodness, that sounds morbid.
It's not. No. It does sound morbid. Yes, it does. But this is actually a perfect storm for Hollywood, this film. I mean, that sounds perfect storm, if a storm is a good thing. we've got this young Doremus, who's a very, very young filmmaker. I mean, he basically at 19, he was the youngest person ever to accept the AFI's Center for Advanced Studies. He got in there. And he's, you know, this is his third feature, which is amazing. He's 28. And he's got fantastic cast. I mean, Anton Yelchin is fantastic. We saw him in Star Trek. You saw Star Trek. Please say yes. Yes, you did. Nod?
Yes, I did, but I might be telling a fib if I did.
That's
Sorry. Okay.
That's fine. Did I make you a liar? Forgive me.
Not at all.
And we've also got Felicity Jones, who is really very good. In fact, she took home a special Sundance Prize for her role here. And this is a love story. It's told in a fresh way. It's got, it does have romantic, drippy music, but it's got a really fresh, living feel. And I think that that's really nice. It's a good antidote to the cynicism that we often have with romances that we see today.
So, I mean, its director Doremus says it's a relationship film.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly does that mean in the context of this film? Because if I try to convince any close friends and relatives to go and see a relationship film, frankly, I think they'd very politely decline.
Well, it's very clever of him to say that, because it's not really about two icons or archetypes. It's about two people. And really, ultimately, that's what a relationship's about. It's about people that we get to care about and understand, and we feel. Because you have to remember, when you go to see a film, I just figured this out, that the actors play us.
Right.
They play parts of us. Otherwise, we're not involved. If we can't really associate ourselves with the people up there, then who cares, right? But we really care about these characters, and that's really what he means. Because this is incredibly, it's incredibly fresh, it's real, and you almost feel like you are them. So that's
it's that good.
I think it's very good, and I think it's particularly good for a younger audience. I mean, maybe some older people would sit back and go, you know, this wasn't what it was like when I did it, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, the relationship is ostensibly taking place over 8 years, and it's the story of what happens before and after this girl has to go back to the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a very long time for two actors, actually, to sustain the part.
Yeah, well, I mean, there have been several, well, yeah, I mean, there are several films that have taken that kind of long approach, like the Anne Hathaway film recently. I'm blaming the Prosecco because I can't remember the title of it. And also, if you think about Before Sunrise, the Julie Delphi film. I mean, a lot of those were about lengthy relationships. And I think it's really about the nature of love and the nature of how we deal with each other over time. And that's the real test.
A lot of this film has been improvised. I think they only had a 50-page script when they were first given it. And then they were given 2 weeks to rehearse and then a very quick turnaround of 5 weeks, straddling both London and Los Angeles. But they say that the most important part was the rehearsal, to try and nail the improvised element of it. How much does it feel like an improvised film?
You know, improvised films, if you have good actors and a good director and a good crew, they feel great. I mean, think about Woody Allen. I mean, some of his stuff's ad-libbed. A lot of people work like Mike Lee works like that. But it's ad-lib with rehearsal, and that's the way it becomes collaborative. I know it sounds pretty terrible to say that, but you want to be able to harness the skills that your actors have. And that's what's really interesting about this, is that he's got a short amount of time, but great actors gives him freedom. I just got done interviewing Ray Fiennes last week, and he's talking about, he's just directed his first film, Coriolanus, no less. But he's talking about how actors, you know, you can't be completely loose as a director, and you can't be completely locked down as a director either. And so it sounds as if Doremus has done just perfectly with this.
Is this going to be the breakthrough film for Felicity Jones? I mean, she's this 27-year-old British actor. She won the special jury prize, like you say, at Sundance. And many of the critics are comparing what she's doing in this to Carey Mulligan in An Education. I mean, she's friends. She's one of these starlets that's friends with Carey Mulligan and, you know, can go for a cup of tea and a bun with Keira Knightley without really worrying about it. And she's also the new face of Burberry. So this is obviously is this her vehicle?
Yeah, I would say it is. I mean, it's difficult to say how it's going to be marketed, how many releases it's going to get, and where it's going to go. But I think the word of mouth on it is very, very good. And I have actually seen her in a film that hasn't even been released yet for next year, and she's very good in that as well. So I'm not supposed to talk about that one.
Okay, that's it. And very briefly about Drake Doremus. I mean, the last thing he did was Douchebag, which didn't do very well. Got very good reviews.
But
was funny and crass and boy-like. And he says this is now his serious film.
That's good. We like that. We like serious films. Yeah, I know. My mother wouldn't let me see Douchebag because she didn't like the title.
No, my mum either.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll stay with the serious. Well, we won't at all. And the next film that we're going to talk about, Karen, if this is all right from you, it's a documentary from the Academy Award winner Errol Morris. It's called Tabloid, and it's the tale of the perfect saucy story. It's got a beauty queen, a kidnap. It takes place in the leafy English environs of 1970s Surrey. And it has the Mormons in it too. Let's have a listen to what's happening in it.
Once upon a time, there was a little princess, the most beautiful little princess in all the land.
Kinky sex, religion, a beauty queen, Mormon missionaries, kidnap at gunpoint. There was something in that story for everyone. It was a perfect tabloid story.
When I met my Kirk, it was like in the movies. When Juliet looks at Romeo and it's pew.
She had fallen in love with him and become obsessed by him.
The next thing I know, he vanished into thin air. I found him in England. The Mormons had him.
Joyce set up this plan.
I knew there was only one way to get Kirk out of Mormonism, and that was to make love with him. Kirk and I went to this cottage. We made love for 3 days. It was like a honeymoon.
Karen Krasanovich, tell me what that's all about, and keep it clean.
Oh, mean, you know, in the 1970s British tabloid kind of way, of course. I like it. Mormon abduction, 3 days of sex. It's got everything, everything, really. It's okay.
What happens?
You have to remember that Earl Morris is a serious documentary maker. He's a serious guy. He did The Fog of War, which is one of the most amazing documentaries you will ever see in your
life. It's incredible. It's very moving.
It's spectacular. He's taken this subject, and it's sort of like a carry-on of documentaries, because it's the story of a very saucy girl who, saucy, that's kind of unfortunate.
Well, she's a beauty queen.
But she also was a trained actress. And she, there's this wonderful, she falls in love with a Mormon missionary who then gets kidnapped to a cottage in Devon.
Oh, right? Sorry, I got it wrong.
And that's quite all right. No, I think she was actually. And there he's shackled to a bed. And she has sex with him for 3 days. And then later, that kind of goes his story, her story, and lots of talking heads, and it ends up with a Korean guy who clones dogs. But it's, yes, I know you're looking at me, and so you should. But it's the less you know about this film, the more fun it is, I have to say. But it's so much fun. It's so well made, and it's really is kind of a trip down to how. You know, how newspapers used to be naughty. It used to be kind of fun. Nobody really got hurt. There was a lot of, you know, lingerie involved, you know.
It's a serious story because in many ways, because she gets convicted in absentia for kidnapping and indecent assault of this man. But when you think about it, if you're looking at it, the British audience will grasp what a tabloid is and will enjoy that sauciness and that kinky side of it. But how far do you think this film will travel?
Well, I think most people are aware of tabloid journalism, and whether they have it in their country or not, I think that there is an element of enjoying these unusual quirks in news media, and I think that this will travel very well. I mean, obviously, some countries may find this a little too racy, but it's on the whole, it's quite a wholesome story, despite the gravity that you were talking about. the thing is the nature. Of what he's asking is, can we get to the truth here?
Okay.
And that's what's really interesting.
Well, for fans of kink and quirk, The Tabloid is your film for this weekend. But finally, let's go on to The Artist, which is an amazing film, an homage to the silent screen. The director, Michael Havanavicius, has enjoyed success with two comedies in his native France, but he's now taking a massive risk with an entirely silent film in black and white. We're going to play a bit of the movie. I don't know what we'll hear from it, though. Let's have a listen. Karen, a mainstream silent movie. Is this going to work?
Wasn't that great? Can't you just picture it already from that music? Yes, this is going to work. In fact, I was back home in Cowtown, Illinois, over the summer, and they were rolling the trailer in a cinema that held like 3 people. So this is going to get an enormous push because it's fun. It really is. It's a look back at the golden days of Hollywood, right on the cusp of talkies. And it's a modern film. It's also got John Goodman in it, Malcolm McDowell. It's got some Penelope and Miller. It's got some wonderful performances and also some tricks, because we also know that Mel Brooks made Silent Movie, where the only person that spoke in it was Marcel Marceau. Ha-ha.
I mean, it is astonishing that the director is saying that he wants people to look at cinema in a new way.
Yeah. Well, you know the old Gloria Swanson said, I believe, in Sunset Boulevard, "We didn't need words then, darling. We had faces." And you can see here that that's the case. This is visual cinema. It's almost like Bean, for example, or any other film that doesn't really need the English language. It doesn't need language at all. And I urge you to see it because it's wonderful.
That's my final question. Out of the three, which one do we see this weekend?
I would say see The Artist.
Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much for coming in to see us at Midori House. Thank you very much for listening as well. That's all from us here at Midori House on Monocle 24. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias, and our studio manager was Anna Veal. In a few moments, we'll join Nick Kelly with the headlines in just a moment. But from all of us, bye-bye.